Please refresh our memory of the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path by simply naming them. The Four Noble Truths are Noble Truth number one, number two, number three, number four. And the Eightfold Path is... Okay, the Four Noble Truths. And sometimes... Okay, the real Four Noble Truths, suffering, the course of suffering, the end of suffering, the way leading to the end of suffering. But, you know, I change them around. Always mess around with things to make them better. So remarket them to have happiness. That's Noble Truth number three, the end of suffering. The cause of happiness. That's Noble Truth number four, the path, Eightfold Path. That there's unhappiness sometimes. You all know that. That's Noble Truth number one. And a cause of unhappiness. Wanting, craving. So those are the Four Noble Truths. If you say suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the way leading to the end of suffering, you all know in marketing the first impression is the one which people go away with. So if you do it like suffering, even you read all these old books, oh, Buddhists are so pessimistic, they only talk about suffering. Because that's how they get to the first Noble Truth and they don't go any further. So that's why... You swap the order around and start with number three, then number four, then number one, then number two. Happiness. So all the Buddhists ever talk about is happiness. That's much better for marketing. And the cause of happiness, the Eightfold Path. And that's a really nice thing to understand, that this path is practice. You're not doing this to get to heaven after you die. You're doing this to get to heaven now, in this life, when you can really enjoy it. So that's why that's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. As it says in verse, I think, 284, Dhammapada, Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. This is the only path. There is no other for the purity of insight. The eightfold path. Not a sevenfold path. Not a six, not a five. So if you really want to purify insight, you have to follow all the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. Number one is right view. Number two is right intention, what I talked about, making peace, being kind, being gentle. Number three is right speech. Shh, shut up, and then you can keep that one. As soon as you open your mouth, it's a chance to say something wrong. Now another one, number four, is right action. In other words, doing kind things. Cleaning up the toilets, washing up, doing all the chores, that's right action. And the next one, right livelihood. And the best livelihood of all is being a monk or a nun. Hey, if you can't be a monk or a nun, then at least having a livelihood which doesn't harm other beings. Like, you know, don't go around sort of running a casino or going around slaughtering animals. And... the fifth is the right effort, and that is the effort to stop, to say no, to renounce, to let go. That takes an effort, that's the heroic effort, to sacrifice. And the seventh factor is right mindfulness, the awareness, knowing what's happening with all the different levels. And the last, number eight, is right stillness. Please don't say concentration in my presence. If you do use the word concentration, just whisper, concentration. It is stillness. So that's the Eightfold Path. You practice each one of those, and then you might become enlightened. So sometimes people say, oh no, just mindfulness. And they don't want to practice right speech, right action, right livelihood. They think they only have to be mindful, and you can do whatever you want the rest of the day. Well, as one person said, they like to become a monk as off. You can't do that. You've got to be a good person. So that is the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Okay. I, stuck in the brightness, cannot go to nimitta. How can I move from there? Don't move. That's why you get stuck, because you're trying to move. If you just allow yourself to be frozen wherever you are in the brightness, you have a good time, and nimitta comes to you. You go chasing these things and they run away. If you're absolutely still, they come towards you. That's how it works. I told you that simile of the emu The Anagarika, years ago, you go and try and find an emu, they run away from you, but if you sit down still long enough, the emu comes to you and sniffs you. It's a very nice thing for you to do. So that's your problem there. You're stuck in the brightness, you're not stuck in the brightness. Enjoy the brightness. What do you think stuck? It's a lovely place to be. Some of the people here will be so jealous. What are you getting into brightness? I've got nothing, and I've been meditating so many hours every day. So remember what I said this morning? Be content to be here. If you're happy to be where you are, then you have the letting go, and then it develops. I can't understand hierarchy and jhana means. Please explain. Oh, that's English words. Hierarchy is when you have somebody better than you, and somebody better than the person better than you, and somebody better than the better than better than you. All these levels of authority. That's hierarchy. And the lastly is jhana. That is these deep meditations. When you get so still, nothing moves. And the world stops. And you're there, totally still. Your body gone. Perfectly at peace. Enjoying every moment. Wow, this is good. With the bliss better than sex. That's what jhana is like. Woohoo, that's fun. In yesterday's Q&A, you mentioned that thoughts are invited. All this time, I believe the thoughts just pop up by themselves. It scared me to know that I am the one who often invites unpleasant thoughts. Seems that I torture my own self. Exactly. What triggers the thoughts to come? Is it because we crave certain feelings, emotions? Very good, that's good insight. It is, because you're used to those emotions. And when they're not there, you feel like a bit homesick. You know, I'm happy and I miss my suffering. You do sometimes. I remember this story of this real scallywag American guru, Baba Ram Dass. He was a Harvard, he was actually a professor at Harvard and got kicked out, you know, for taking drugs. But he went off to India, became a guru, grew his hair. But he wrote some interesting stories in his books. And one of the things he did, you know, one of his disciples, this young girl, her father was sick in hospital, really sick with some sort of painful disease. And his daughter said, "Why don't I bring my guru in?" Now, this was about 40 years ago. You know, like Americans are just so sort of conservative. And this was one of these conservative men. They didn't want anyone to do with these hopeless, long-haired, good-for-nothing hobos. But she decided to bring her guru in to the bedroom, the hospital room. And when her father saw this weirdo coming into his hospital room, even though it was a friend of his daughter, he said, "No, get out of here. I don't want to hear anything to do with this guy." But obviously he wanted to see his daughter. So his daughter was by the bed talking to him. And the guru had nothing else to do. So he started to give this man a foot massage. And after about 2 or 3 minutes of foot massage, all the pain disappeared in this girl's father. It was almost a miracle. And as soon as all the pain disappeared, he shouted him, "Get away from my feet!" Because he'd rather have the pain and not have his philosophy of life challenged, and be free of pain and having to admit that there was this weird guy with long hair had been responsible for doing something the doctors couldn't. It's amazing how attached we are to our philosophies, our religions, our views, much more so than wanting to get rid of pain. It's amazing just how attached we can be. So that's what happens. You're attached to your pain. You got used to it after a while. That's who you are. Sometimes you are the victim of what happened to you early on in life. And you associate with that so strongly, you just cannot let it go. To let go of your grief, or to let go of your guilt, or to let go of your anger, would be to let go of who you think you are, and to create a totally different new person. And that's a bit too difficult for us. All attachment to the self. Tomorrow I will talk about insight, and especially non-self. and how to let go of this image of who you think you are. And when you can let go of the image of who you think you are, then all this associations with how you were hurt when you were young and how you did rotten things to other people and whoever you think you are, you can totally let it all go. None of it is you, which means you're not attached. You've got no vehicle to attach you to the past. The vehicle is your sense of self. So that means you can let go of all these things. So you don't have to identify with all this old stuff. The old torturing thoughts from the past no longer come up. Why? Because they're nothing to do with me. None of my business. Isn't that wonderful? That's one of my favorite sayings. None of my business. So you come and dump all your problems on me. Yes, I listen to you, but they're none of my business. As I said, it opened the door of your heart. It's one of the teachings of Ajahn Chah. He knew that as a monk, you have to be a counselor. He knew that one day you'd be sitting there, you know, outside the office with a cup of tea, and all these people were telling you all these stupid things about their meditation and their life, and all about their family and their children and their wives and their husbands and their work. And that's why you become a monk, so you don't have those problems. So I don't have wife problems. That's why I became a monk, to avoid all of that. I don't have any problems with my children, because I don't have any. I don't have anything problems with my boss, because I don't have a boss. I don't go to work. I don't have those problems. I'm free. What do? You give me all your problems. But you are compassionate. You open the door of your heart, but only because Ajahn Chah's great simile, monks and nuns, sisters, you've got to be dustbins. Trash cans. So people can come and visit and dump all of their pain and problems into you. And you must always be open to that, because that's your job. But you have to be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. That's Ajahn Chah's brilliant sort of metaphor. And I often think of that when you come to your interviews. Yeah, I pay full attention, I accept everything you say. But literally, as soon as you've gone, it's all gone out of me as well. I don't keep it, honest. I'm a trash can with a hole in the bottom. And that's why it's very nice. All of that past can go. It's called letting go. Why do you carry that around? I don't carry it around because all of your problems, it's none of my business. And I look at my problems, it's the same, it's none of my business. Everything I've done in the past, all those bad jokes, I'm sorry, it's none of my business. I'm a trash can. I'm always open. It's not just opening the door of my heart, it's opening the door at the other end as well. So it just all goes through and you keep nothing. Ah, here we go. This is a really deep question. Ajahn, is being reborn as a woman bad karma? Certain monks said so. Thanks. Absolutely, that's the fundamental truth. You argue with that? Of course, that's an absolutely stupid thing to say. Being reborn as a woman, bad karma. It's being reborn as anything is bad karma. The best thing is not to be reborn. But no, you might say that in some societies, you know, being reborn sort of as an outcast in some societies, say in India, or being reborn as a very poor beggar in some societies as a result of bad karma. In some societies, women are put down. So if you were reborn as a woman, say in like Saudi Arabia, then probably, yeah, that's a bit of bad karma. But sort of, it's not because you're a woman, it's where you're born and what particular state, family and stuff you're born. So each one of you, to have been reborn sort of as a woman in Singapore, in Australia, in Indonesia, in the United States, in Vietnam. Who else you put me for? Oh, in, where's Belgium somewhere? Where are they today? Okay, whatever. In the countries you've been reborn in, that's good karma. I often tell people, it was bad karma. I must have done some terrible karma to be reborn in England. So cold. I won't do that again. So the answer, that's absolutely stupid. Monks who say that. And why do you allow monks to say that? That's a more interesting question. Why don't you challenge them? Say, that's stupid. That's unfair. That is absolutely wrong. Because one of the problems is you don't give enough feedback to monks. This monk you give enough feedback to. But some of those monks sometimes were so respectful that they don't get any feedback at all, which means they continue saying these very offensive things and very wrong things. So please give feedback to your monks and nuns. That was one of the wonderful things of coming to Australia, because you can't get away with saying that rubbish. You know, you get argued with, you get hit, you get sort of, you can't say that, Ajahn Brahm, you get taken to court or whatever. So that's actually very healthy, that you give the monks and the nuns feedback. And I'll give you feedback too. Because that way we can actually have progress. Yes. Yep.
They said that even Venerable Ananda, he committed adultery in one of his past lives, and he had to pay the price by being reborn as a monkey for 500 lives. And but he's not a happy monkey because his private parts were bitten off every life.
That's a good story to tell. When you're thinking of committing adultery, it's not just being born as a monkey 500 times, having your genitals bitten off. For a man, that makes even me squirm. Ooh. Yeah, I know. But that may have... We don't know if that's true or not. That's not in the suttas anyway. If you look at the suttas, it's not mentioned in there at all. That's commentarial. In other words, it's not said by the Buddha, therefore it's not authoritative. So I don't really believe that, because all those commentaries are written by monks. Nothing else to do is sit in a room and write instead of meditating. So I don't believe in that. Bullshit. Go on, say it. Yeah. Well, you can say. If you say it's a monk, you can say it's Gomayang. 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 That's Pali for bullshit. Now that's interesting. Who should you respect, the monk or the Dhamma? You should always respect truth above the person. And you're not disrespecting the monk, you're disrespecting what he said or what she said. That's what you're disrespecting. It's a good monk. Ajahn Gan has a great monk. I really respect him, but I disrespect what he said. That's actually a great teaching. It's in the Arana Vibhanga Sutra, the teaching on non-conflict. You never criticize a person. You never say, you're a bad woman. You're a stupid monk. You say that was a stupid thing you said. The act was stupid. The speech was stupid, but not the person. Now that is avoiding conflict. Because when somebody said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you're terrible. You just tell such terrible jokes. It's okay to say you tell terrible jokes, I'll admit that, but not to say that the person is terrible. Because sometimes I actually tell a new joke and a good joke. Not that often, but you know, sometimes. But that's such a beautiful thing about non-conflict. You criticize an act. That's a stupid thing which you did. But you don't criticize a person. And I really kept that in mind during that bhikkhuni. I never criticized Wat Pa Pong, but I criticized what they did. And that's really important to do that. Yeah. As because there's too many people who, instead of giving money to the charities around India, they give it to the beggars. You should never actually give the money to the beggars, because some of that is, you know what actually happens, some of those are professional beggars, and it's the people who manage them get most of the money. If they don't get enough, they get beaten, or it's going to be so cruel in there. And instead of doing that, there are many societies around Bodh Gaya. The Sri Lankan temple is brilliant there. You give the money to them, and they make sure those kids have good schooling, education, a place to stay. But if you give the money straight to the beggars, it just goes to the people who manage them. And I've seen that many times. And I must be disgusted at the Thai temple in Bodh Gaya. Incredibly ornate. Just beautiful, like it's straight out of the Royal Palace in Bangkok. So beautiful, so ornate, with a big wall around it, while there were beggars outside. And the Sri Lankan temple, you know, so I can criticize Sri Lanka, criticize Thailand. This is just that particular place. And the Sri Lankan temple, it's, you know, run down, needs a paint job, because all the money, they give it to their orphanage, and their free medical and everything else. And that really inspired me when I saw what the Sri Lankan temple was doing in Bodh Gaya and what some of the other temples were doing. It's the heart of Buddhism. You should be kind. And that's also why whenever we build anything here, it's comfortable this way, but it's not ornate. We haven't got, you know, filigree or any extras here. It's just a plain walls, you know, plain floor. You've got a bit of stuff on there, that flower stuff, whatever it is. But it's not, you can't say this is an ornate place. But some of the sort of the artwork on the temples, it should be a museum or not in a temple. But anyway, that's my little thing anyway. But that's one of the reasons why there's beggars. There's no real need. Anyway, Dear Ajahn, why do monks in Australia still shave their eyebrows? I thought it's just from the Thai history. It's hard to promote monasticism to a new generation if we keep follow Asian culture rather than what the Buddha taught. Now, one of the reasons why the monks actually shave their eyebrows, this was actually pointed out in a discussion online, it was a very good one, is actually when you shave your eyebrows, the monks actually look like little babies. And they actually become much more sort of lovable. And it's true, if you have big bushy eyebrows, it actually, you know, it makes you a little bit less compassionate looking. So you try it. If you see monks with eyebrows, they look much fiercer than the monks with no eyebrows. And it's like the baby look. That's all you're getting. Because that's very controversial. I'm sure that was written by one of the monks. Dear Ajahn, to the person, but it's such a small thing, shaving your eyebrows, if that's going to stop you becoming a monk or get you upset with Buddhism, that's a pretty, you know, awful. So we do that because, you know, just the tradition we've done so far. And it doesn't harm anybody. To the person who asked about current display of psychic powers, okay, there is a restaurant, Kambar, at Clark Quay, which used to be an old mansion. It's now called the Forbidden City. Clark Quay, that's in Singapore, isn't it? Yeah. There's a restaurant, Kambar, at Clark Quay, which used to be an old mansion. It's now called the Forbidden City. It had many spirits in there. To tame them after many attempts, they brought in Ajahn Tate, who did so and left 4 palm prints on the concrete slabs of the signage using his psychic powers. You can still see them there today. No, it wasn't Ajahn Tate, that was Ajahn Dik, another monk. He was a disciple of Ajahn Tate. And it's only one palm print thing I've seen, if they try to paint over, but it's come out again. Isn't that weird? But it's only a palm print. Surely you can do something a bit more spectacular than that. That's one of the problems, you know, these psychic powers, they're just, you know, they're not sort of really powerful things. See if you could get, like, the sign to levitate up, you know, that'd be really good. Because, you know, sometimes you have all these people with superpowers on the movies now. And, you know, they can do much better than that. Imagine if Superman, all he could do was leave a palm print somewhere and you paint over and it came out again. You know, he wouldn't actually get very far in his career as a superhero. But, yeah, okay, there's some things like that. So, there are psychic powers around, but a lot of times the monks don't display them because if they did, they would become a freak. In other words, people will come to see you not to hear teachings on Dhamma, not to hear how to meditate. They'll just come here to see another freaky psychic power. It'll just be like a circus. And Bodhinyana Monastery, that's what would become, Bodhinyana Circus, where all the monks would perform their tricks. And everybody would clap and shout and ask for more. And that's not what Buddhism is about. So sometimes the psychic powers can distract you from the real meaning of Buddhism, which is actually to teach you so you don't have any suffering anymore, you're happy, you're at peace, you gain insight. And that is why the Buddha said that's the only psychic power which he really, really praises. All the rest are just distractions. But why is it you want to see psychic powers? Just you're bored, you know, you've been to see the Great Wall of China, you've done bungee jumping, you've done all this other extreme stuff, so now you're bored, you want to see something you've never seen before. Something new. Just like people want to hear new jokes. You can't hear new jokes all the time. There's only so many jokes in the world. You want to hear more stories from me. I've only been around 60 years and a bit, so you know there's only a certain amount of life I've lived. So anyway, I'm just moaning again. Dear Ajahn Brahm, regarding letting go of unwholesome past karma, why did Venerable Moggallana have to be beaten to death for his past karma for beating his parents? I think he tried to kill his parents. Being enlightened, he must have forgiven himself and it must have been an ahosi karma. Please enlighten us on this issue. Okay, that's a very good point. Because there's one type of karma you can't sort of just let go of, and that's called the antarayaka karmas, such as killing your parents. So that's, they say there's some strong karmas that you just can't let go. Even if you forgive yourself, still there's some sort of physical consequence to that. So those things which you have to deal with is killing your parents, killing an enlightened being, raping a nun. So be very careful. Don't do anything like that. Otherwise, that's really bad. Antarayaka karma. What are the other ones? Oh, it's creating a schism. And also, it's taking the blood of a Buddha. Like, it's causing the Buddha to lose some blood. In other words, it was Devadatta rolled a rock down the hill and it sort of caused the Buddha to have a cut. That's supposed to be really bad karma. So you can't do that these days because no Buddha around. And it's only other monks actually can cause a schism. And so as long as you haven't killed your parents, you're okay.
Did you cause a schism?
No, not me. That's actually not causing a schism. I never threw anybody out. It's the people who throw you out. They're the ones who have to be careful. So that's another thing. I better not go into that. But yes, someone did cause a schism. Dear Ajahn, when the stillness is developed, I feel peace and really enjoy the breath. Great. When the time is no longer, I found out that my nose tense up. When the time is longer, oh yeah, I feel that my nose tense up. Which area should I notice the breath? As I try at the head parts and chest part, but it's still not comfortable. Sometimes I even heard heartbeat. Please advise. If you hear the heartbeat, just move away and go back to the breath, because that's not a comfortable thing to watch. But the where to watch the breath nowhere. So don't try and look at the nose. Don't try and look at the tummy. Don't try and look anywhere on the body. See if you can notice the breath without locating it anywhere on your body. So you know the breath is going in, but you don't know where it's going in. And that is fine. That's the best thing to do. Dear Ajahn, people who are getting headaches need to drink more water. WA is a very dry place, and we need to drink more water. But if you drink more water, we'll have less water in WA. So no, don't drink more water, otherwise we'll run out. So my solution to that is, the biggest waste of water in Australia is beer. Because when people, I remember drinking beer, as soon as you drink beer, it's this diuretic, it sort of comes out the other end almost shortly afterwards. It's a total waste of water because you don't keep any. It just goes right through you. That's really a great waste of water. So I think to keep more water in Australia, we should pass a law banning beer. It'd be a riot, yeah, sure. But yeah, no, it is true that sometimes you get headaches, it's dehydration. And it has been hot the last couple of days, so maybe just drink a bit more water, that may actually get rid of the headaches. And it's not really tension headaches, it's just a natural dehydration. But it may be tension headaches as well, especially if it's across the forehead here. That's a dinky dye, clear sign you've got some tension. Ajahn Brahm, I've listened to lots and lots of talks given by you on the internet. You must be enlightened now. But yet to hear one on dependent origination. Question and answer is not a time to explain the whole, but maybe, if possible, explain where the chain could be broken. Now, that is one of those vipassana myths, where it can be broken. If you look at dependent origination, you can see it is once awija is overcome. In other words, you've got insight, you've got understanding, you see the Dhamma, then the whole path unravels. However, in some people say, no, if you have feeling and you don't sort of, if you've got insight, then it doesn't lead to craving and these other things. That is stupidity. The Buddha never said that. Once you see the truth, you get insight, avijja, delusion, is overcome. Once delusion is overcome, then the whole thing unravels. That is how dependent origination is stopped. And there is this wonderful little sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. And Bhikkhu Bodhi did this wonderful translation. He called it transcendental dependent origination. It was actually just how the whole thing ceases. And I think Ajahn Brahmali gave a talk on that on a Friday night recently. And basically what it is, if I remember it correctly, you understand the suffering in life, it's very difficult, so you come to places like this. And you hear the teachings, and that gives you inspiration. Actually, this makes sense. And from the inspiration, the pramuja, you get pity. And it's inspiring, and you like listening to the talks. It's fun, it's just enjoyable. And from the pity, because you're having fun, the body becomes tranquil. You can meditate, you can sit still. Now, this is really important. It's only if you have the joy that your body can be still. If you just haven't got any joy, you're suffering. That's one of the great causes of restlessness. Remember, when you're content, you're happy, then you're not restless. The body becomes still, and then the mind experiences happiness. Beautiful breath, nice nimittas, and then you get samadhi, stillness. There's no stillness without happiness. Sukhino chittang samadhiyati. From happiness, from this blissful breath, this beautiful nimittas, from there you get still. That's why I really encourage that happiness. Without it, you can't get stillness, you can't get sort of nimittas or jhanas. And from that stillness, you see things as they truly are. You get the insight. And then everything sort of... from seeing things as they truly are, you get free vimutti, free from all the cravings and the attachments, and then you get the knowledge of freedom. It's basically just this little path. So it's like a cause and effect, one thing leads after the other. And that tells you just how this whole thing happens. Breaking the chain is just something which is invented a long time after the Buddha. It's not really, really Buddhism as far as I can see. Yes? Yeah.
The third question that he answered 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I had question time.
Yeah.
He said the place where you break it is later and put a different name tag on it. So maybe you listen to the tape or something.
Yeah, yeah. No. That's wonderful. I'm so happy about that. Because if all my monks were just were clones of Ajahn Brahm, I'd be very worried that they're just brainwashed. If they told the same jokes as I did, I'd also be very worried. Because if monks don't argue with you, if they all think the same, then that's a very bad sign that it's a cult. So I'm glad he thinks for himself. He happens to be wrong, but at least he thinks for himself. Dear Bhante, in Zen, there are minor insights, Kensho, attainable before the main enlightenment insight, Satori. Are there parallels to this in Theravada? Of course there are. You get lots of minor insights until you get the big ones. So that's actually, I'll talk about that later. Many insights, one of the insights is like insights in how to be peaceful, insights in how to meditate. Tomorrow I'll tell you that this path of looking for stillness and really going into deep meditation, because you're going deep, that really opens up incredible insights. Why is it I can't stay with a delightful breath? Why is it that a thought comes in? Why is it that I can't let go of the body and just enter this beautiful nirmitas and jhanas? Why? That's where you get the insights. When you're going deep, you're letting go, and there's a block. You can't go further. That is the place you find the insights. That is when you find what you're attached to and why. If you had no attachments, if you understood, there'll be no barrier between you and the jhanas. You'll be able to flow right in with no obstacles. Because there are obstacles, that is some attachments there. And that is where you get your insights. But anyway, I'll go into that tomorrow. I recall the Mahasiddhanta tradition lists 10 insights preceding stream entry. Knowledge of terror, knowledge of disillusion, etc. But I think these are Abhidharma conditions. Yes. So some of those things, so even though they're Abhidharma, are very true. I mean, I already mentioned the terror, the fear which comes up in meditation. So some of those insights are okay, but not everybody has to get all the 10. This is not sort of like some A-level course or O-level course where you have to know all of these things in the right order. It's not classified that way. People are just too idiosyncratic. Dear Ajahn, are the three factors of the second part of the Eightfold Path all are partly aspects of the Third Noble Truth? Nice question. Can peace be understood as freedom from the stress of desire? Can kindness be understood as love or nurture, or even not roosting in the pain of craving or ill will? Okay, these are all overlapping as they normally do. The three factors of the second part of the Eightfold Path, I said, is making peace, being kind, being gentle. The making peace bit is usually like letting go. It's nekama, it's renunciation. But sometimes when it's talked about renunciation, we have to know what we are renouncing. And sometimes people renounce the wrong things. The old story of one of the disciples here in Perth, Australian guy, and he decided he really wanted to become a Buddhist and to keep the 5 precepts. And of course, the most difficult precept to keep in Australia is the 5th, not drinking. But he was very, very resigned to, he really wanted to keep these 5 precepts, very determined. So when he went to the first function at his work, and they started giving out the wine or the beer, whatever it was they were serving, he said no. And the person serving said, "Why aren't you drinking? You used to drink." And he said, "No, I've now become a Buddhist, and I don't drink." And a man serving said, "Oh, you're a Buddhist, well done. I really respect Buddhism. Buddhism teaches letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink." So when we're talking about renouncing, we're not talking about renouncing your precepts. We're not talking about renouncing your compassion. You're not talking about renouncing your letting go, because that's what that Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh did. He said, no, I've gone much further than non-attachment. I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. Which meant he was an excuse to do whatever he wanted. I let go so much. Years ago, I let go of letting go. Now that sort of stuff, you're renouncing the wrong thing. So you've heard on this retreat, it's very clear, what you renounce in that first part of the second factor of the Eightfold Path, you renounce the doer, the controller, the will, the craving. It's the thing in here you renounce, not what's out there. That's what you let go of. That's why I call it like making peace. Because making peace is not controlling. It's not doing anything with things. It's having a ceasefire in your battle with yourself and the world. You make peace. So that's where the nakama. Because sometimes renouncing, yeah, you give away your family, you give away your money, you give away everything, but you've got to give away your control. You can give away everything and live life as a monk and still be a control freak. Because you haven't given away the main thing, which is the most important. So, making peace, being kind, being gentle, and the aspects of the Third Noble Truth I said this morning is the first one was giving. Yeah, that's kindness, you might say, and a bit of wisdom. The second one is freedom, and that really is making peace. You know, you're happy to be here, no matter where you are. And the second one was giving things away. That is, I suppose, kindness. And the third one was like the freedom, and the last one was having nothing sticks to you. Yeah, it's sort of have an overlap, but not perfect overlap. So yeah, it's close enough. Dear Ajahn, I have noticed you have made reference to Christianity over the past few days. I have also seen it discussed in a mocking tone. You also stated that the Bible lacked wisdom. I'm aware these comments drew laughter. I am wondering, in today's environment of religious intolerance and conflicts, shouldn't we celebrate the similarities in faith rather than belittle or make fun of things we don't agree with or doubt or understand? I personally see the Dharma in Christ's teachings and see him as a Buddha. I just think the way his teachings have been shared and the cultural influences that have impacted his message make them different from modern-day Buddhism. In fact, I see a truth in all the major faiths. As a religious leader, do you feel a responsibility towards a message of tolerance and harmony with other faiths, or should we remain exclusive and single-minded to a single brand of Buddhism? It's a nice question. It's a good question. Sometimes, for so many years, I was afraid of criticizing other religions, as if that's not what a religious person should do. And as a result of that, just so much misbehavior goes on in other religions, and also in Buddhism as well. So really, we should criticize what is worthy of criticism. And I don't think like tolerance for tolerance sake is really going to get us anywhere. So I can't sort of tolerate terrorists going bombing. I will not tolerate sort of people who circumcise young girls because they say that's part of our religion. What really inspired me, or interested me, encouraged me, I think was the word I was looking for, in, I think it was 2001, the French government passed the law limiting religious freedom. They said if any religion, and they don't care what religion it is, if anything they do goes against fundamental human rights and freedoms, then it is outlawed. It is not legal in France. Good on the French, because they recognized that human rights and freedoms were much more important than religious freedom. In fact, so much bad conduct is protected under religious freedom because people aren't brave enough to criticize religion or cultures. They think, oh, that's just culture. You know, you can't criticize it. You know, in Australia, the indigenous community have spearings as punishments. And sometimes that's protected. That's the culture. That's what they've been doing for years and years. But sometimes I think it should be criticized. I don't think that's a good thing to do. You may not agree with me, but certainly I have the right to criticize and say we disagree. And sometimes cultural fear, Religious fear means no one gets criticized. So yeah, there's certain things in the Bible which I do criticize. And other people have criticized too. And I also criticize Buddhism as well. I criticize people who just take on the Abhidharma as truth. And I think that's a healthy thing to do. And you criticize me, and please keep on doing that. In the same way, I will sometimes criticize the parts of Christianity which I don't think are worthy. Why not? Otherwise, if we're afraid of criticism, you know, we get into sort of people who hide behind the banner of religious freedom and religious intolerance, or tolerance, whatever it is, and to do really crazy things. So I think, especially Buddhists, you know, sometimes the other religions will say bad things about us, and we won't defend ourselves. But when other religions do stupid things, Angie saw me writing an email this morning. That was to Henry, who's on an interfaith board in Singapore, and they come up against conversions. They should know, because it's a very sensitive issue in places like Singapore. Should we allow conversions? Should we disallow conversions? Because what happens is there are some Christian groups. Muslim groups don't do it, Buddhist groups don't do it, Hindu groups don't do it, Christian groups do it. Who go to people's bedside when they're dying. And they just go and badger the person. They won't leave. They go with their pastor and their friends, you know, six or seven, I don't know how many of them, and they badger the person, and they won't give them any peace until they convert. Is that religious freedom? Or is that ethically wrong? And so many people say, no, we can't speak up against that. That's people's right to convert. And the Sri Lankan government was smart enough to make the point, although it got beaten down, and I don't know why, because they had a very strong point. They said, let's call it unethical conversions against ethical conversions. There is a distinction. Conversion is fine if it's done ethically. You have good arguments. You know, you listen to people and you make your choice. Unethical, and I refer this to Henry, look at Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which guarantees the freedom of choice of religion or no religion. It was that freedom of choice which was your human rights. And if that freedom of choice is obstructed by coercion or by exploiting the vulnerable, like people who are dying or sick in hospital, who need you as a nurse, and they feel that for some reason they won't get the same care if they don't convert, that is unethical. That is coercion. That's taking away your freedom of choice. That is unethical. So there is such a thing as unethical conversions, unethical religious practice, unethical consideration of truth, where you have to believe otherwise that you are scared that you're going to go to hell. That sort of stuff I don't believe in, and I'm going to speak up about that, however, whatever people say about me. Against that, there are other parts of Christianity which are fine. But there is a part of Christianity, and especially relevant in places like Singapore, and here in Australia as well, which really abuse people's freedom of choice of religion or no religion. And that is unethical, and we should speak up against that. And if that happens in Buddhism, we also speak up against it. There was a recent case. It was brought to our attention by Ajahn Sujato, and Buddhists speak up against it. There was a woman, a Sri Lankan woman in Sydney, whose daughter wanted to convert to being a Christian. And she, I think, beat her daughter to try and stop her. That is not acceptable. That is wrong. And if it's a Buddhist doing it, a Christian doing it, we, the Buddhist leaders in Australia, we will be consistent and fair. It's not whether you're a Christian becoming a Buddhist or a Buddhist becoming a Christian or a Muslim, whatever. There are some things which are obviously unethical, coercion. It's against the Declaration of Human Rights, which is a beautiful document which points out basic human freedoms. Where religion takes away that freedom, the religion is wrong and should be criticized. So, I'm a monk who will not just stand and say, oh yeah, all religions are worthy, and not be brave enough to criticize some religions. Or Islam as well. The worst thing about Islam, one of the worst things about Islam, is where it will not allow people to marry between different religions. And if you're in Malaysia, it means if, and this has happened many times, these Buddhist girls have come up to me, they've fallen in love, and they have to convert to being a Muslim. So that's wrong. You've taken away your freedom. Yes. Singapore, they're forced? No, not in Singapore, no. Not even in Indonesia. It's a Malaysian thing. Yeah. In Thailand, the Buddhists should be strong enough to say, no, I'm going to be a Buddhist. If you love me, then you should be willing to love me as a Buddhist. Stand up and be strong. That's one of the problems. Buddhists aren't critical enough, aren't strong enough. Even they're not critical of monks who say that being born as a woman is bad karma. I will stand up for you about that. So I think that's really, really important. If Buddhism is going to actually grow in this world and we're going to be preserving this beautiful teaching, I think we should be more courageous. Don't be aggressive, but at least we should, you know, stand up for what we believe in. Yeah, go on. Oh, great. Well, I did actually say a few nice things about Christianity and Islam, but
in general.
Yeah, because sometimes that people realize that you're just criticizing, not respecting. Mm. Yeah. Saying about Australia, yes?
Yes,
Yeah, the equal opportunity doesn't apply to religions, and the Buddhists fought for including religions, but it was blocked by people like Cardinal Pell.
And the other struggle too is that we don't have the ability to impose human rights as America.
Yep. They're blocked by the religious lobby.
Yes.
Yeah, but not by the Buddhists. We are very active doing that. And that's what I get a bit upset in Australia when the other Christians say, well, all the religions, we're all together on this. And the Buddhists say, no, we are not. But they never hear us. Sorry? Yeah, no, I'd said that on Philip Adams' show. When it comes to Buddhism, we are a religion. For tax purposes, at least. We're defined as a religion. There's a very beautiful debate in the House of Lords about 30, 40 years ago. Really high quality. And they made very strong arguments that yes, Buddhism qualifies as a religion. What it did was change the meaning of religion to include Buddhism. And that's one of the arguments in my paper for gay marriage. People who say, no, marriage means between a man and a woman. Words change their meaning to be more inclusive. Religion has changed its meaning to include Buddhism. There's no reason why marriage can't be more inclusive to include unions between two men or two women. It's not a logical argument to say a word never changes its meaning. Even the word gay has changed its meaning, as everybody knows. Yeah.
Or principle.
Yeah. Not necessarily a being. Okay, let's go on from the social activist, Ajahn. How do we know that the first stage of our meditation, which is the present moment, is strong, firm and well established? Okay, that if it's good enough, so you know your mind doesn't go off into the past or the future, you're pretty much here and now. And after a while, you understand that this is, I haven't mentioned this yet, the three levels of each stage of meditation: recognition, familiarity and ease. Recognition is when you understand what the present moment is. What do we mean by the present moment? What actually is it as an experience? When you recognize it, then you become familiar with it. You understand, you know what the present moment is. Just like, you know, when you first come here, you don't know where the places are, where the room is, where the toilets are, where the dining hall is, you know, where the interview place is. But after a few days, you recognize it, become familiar with it, and the last stage is you're at ease with it. It's like a second home. Same with things like the present moment. You recognize what it is, and after much recognition, you're so familiar with this is the present moment. And through that familiarity, you can be at ease, you can rest there. You don't have to hold it. This is an old friend. When you're an old friend, you relax. But if it's a new person you've never met before, you're a bit tense. You know, who are they? What should I do? How should I relate? But with an old friend, you're totally at ease. And those are the levels with every stage of meditation, even nimitta. A lot of people ask, you know, is this a nimitta? You know, what is a nimitta? After a while, you recognize it. And when you recognize it, you're so familiar with it, it's a nimitta again. Then you can relax, you won't control it because you're at ease with it. Ease means no control, you can just stay there. So this is the present moment. When it stays there, you recognize that you're familiar. When it stays there, then you achieve that part of the meditation. It is a well-accepted fact that all of us should exercise aggressively for 30 to 45 minutes, four to five times a day. A well-accepted fact. I'll challenge that one. Some people say that we should exercise aggressively for 30 to 45 minutes, 4 to 5 times a week. Level exercise should pump the heart to at least 50 to 60% of capacity and should be sustained for 30 to 45 minutes. Nuns and monks don't get this level of exercise. Can I give a treadmill, or is it against the Vinaya Pitaka? It's amazing. I have so many monks who don't go on a treadmill and they live to 80, 90, 100 years of age. It's a well-established fact that people who don't worry live a long life. So be careful. Thank you for your wonderful teachings and for being here to guide us. You are truly special, kind and the best. May you always have much health and happiness. Ah, oh, isn't that nice? That one I will keep, I won't throw that away. You know I deserve that. Remember that teaching I gave? Why is it that somebody praises you like this? How I was taught, oh, it's nothing, that's just who I am. You don't need to exaggerate. You know, I'm just an ordinary monk. But why is it that someone criticizes and, oh, you really badmouth Christianity all the time, thing, oh, gee. Why is it we accept criticism really easy, but we never accept praise? So with the praise, yes, I deserve this. I accept it. I do that so you too would accept praise. So you're an amazing caretaker, Daniel. Isn't she a great caretaker? You accept that? Really? You're wonderful, two nuns here. Aren't they beautiful nuns here? It's great. Go. And you're amazing meditators here. That's incredible. Come on. You didn't accept it, did it? You laughed. Anyway, here we go again. At the beginning of the meditation, I tend to be aware of the breath by noticing the air coming in and out of the nose area. Later on, when the breath becomes very slow and subtle, I can either be aware of the air at the nose area or the subtle sensation of the chest area. Which one should you focus on? Neither. I've already mentioned that. Just notice the breath. Don't notice where it's happening. Why does jhana lead to and how? Oh, why does jhana lead to stream entry and a permanent change? What if you forget next lifetime? I'll tell that tomorrow about insight and how the jhanas leads to the deep insights. And if it's stream entry, and then when you get reborn, this is a question which we contemplated, and my explanation of this is accepted by other monks as well. If you become a streamer in this life, So when you die, you may go to some heaven realm or get reborn quickly or whatever it is. When you get reborn, you won't remember a thing about your stream entry or the Dhamma. You won't, as soon as the first word you say, you know, when the baby won't say, Namo Tassa Bhagavato. You probably the first word say, Goo Goo Ga Ga Ga. Daddy, Daddy, Mummy. But you'll obviously be a good person. You're inclined towards things like Buddhism. You discover the Dhamma, and you'll recreate that experience which made you a streamer the last time. You'll re-experience that insight which sees into non-self. You have to. So it's if you were a stream winner the last lifetime, you'll have the same experience this lifetime as well. You become a stream winner again. Oh no, you've got a couple of lifetimes gone, so it's not seven lifetimes, only five left. So you're much closer. You're making advancement, so you don't lose. So you've gained. You're closer. Dear Ajahn, for a while now, at times on retreats, when I see my fellow retreatants, despite their grace and loveliness, this horrible, filthy language comes up. This is interesting. Sometimes even towards a sangha. It's embarrassing, and I'm very ashamed. You said thoughts don't just arise, we drag them in. I really wish I stopped dragging these in. With sincere apologies for the foul thoughts. If you really want to do something to stop them, you know what you should do? Stand up and say them. And then you really get embarrassed. There was one of the monks I grew up with. He's a really good monk, but he really had a lot of trouble with lust. And he tried his very best, and after a while he had to disrobe. And they really respect him because he was really trying. He really had a strong, lustful character. And one day he went to see Ajahn Chah and said, look, I think all these sexual fantasies and I just can't stop. Can you please help me? He really wanted to sort of be a good monk. So Ajahn Chah said, I've got the perfect solution, guaranteed to work. The next time all the lay people come to the monastery to listen to a talk, you give the talk and you tell them in detail about all your sexual fantasies. And he said, I can't do that. That's why he eventually disrobed. But no, he's a really good guy. He's really still a good friend. But, that's so hard to do, isn't it? It's embarrassing. But as long as you're restraining these things and you're not speaking it out, after a while it just disappears. So don't feel guilty about it. Just leave it alone. Sometimes you just get really fed up sometimes. So it'll just disappear after a while. Dear Emptiness. Oh, that's my title, not Ajahn. Somebody many years ago, how do you correctly address, someone like me, like a monk or a nun? And, venerable, you're reverent, or, your holiness. No, your emptiness. That is the title I like. So you can call me your emptiness. You can call the nuns your extreme emptinesses. Your ultimate emptiness. You have a bit of sense of humour. So your emptiness. It's clear we don't own this body. We don't own this mind either, as we can't control it. So where does this will come from? Exactly. It comes just from habit, from conditioning. It's actually brainwashed into you. That's amazing when you actually see that. It's scary too. Even writing this question, you had no choice. You had to write this question. It did not come from you. It appeared to come from you, but it did not come from you. There was a wonderful experiment done by Professor Libet, Libet. He became famous for this. He wanted to find out whether simple acts of will come from you or not. His experimenters were asked to flex their fist, open and close it, whenever they wanted to. And when they decided, or when they were aware of the choice to open the wrist they would press a button with their other hand. So when they decide, they open their wrist, open their fist, and they press the button. At the same time, he had this gizmo on the brain to be able to notice when there was this thing called readiness potential appear in the brain. Because the brain has to, you know, start the process which actually opens the fist. And you can actually see it, the light goes on in the brain. And then the fist opens. He wanted to find out whether the will came before the readiness potential or after the readiness potential. And what he found, you know, making a count of reaction times and coordinating when they press, and that's when they were aware of the will. And he found actually that the readiness potential came first. The brain lit up. And then the thing which we recognize as will appears to our consciousness. And then we do something. Basically, what we understand and perceive as a will does not start the process, but it is somewhere in the middle of the process. The process starts, then we will it, then it happens. By the time we will it, it's already happening. Your will is not the generator of these things. It appears after it's inevitable. That is scary, but that is true. So putting your hand up. You didn't choose to put your hand up. The brain turned on, and you put your hand up, but you were aware of something which you took to be your choice. That's a delusion. By the time you made that choice, you didn't make the choice. It was already happening. It was part of the process, not the beginning of the process.
Is that not deterministic, though? My question.
It's not deterministic, because determinism in philosophy or theology means it's all determined by a God. It's all in a big plan.
Right.
It's not deterministic because it's also, I have to go to mass chaos theory, the influences are so complex. Now, why you do what you want, why you do what you do, it's so complicated that no one can actually predict it. It's unpredictable, uncertain, what's going to happen next. But after a while you see that what you do, you had no choice. If you don't do it, you had no choice not to do it. And that really takes away a fundamental part of who we think we are. That's why this whole letting go business is so powerful. But, okay, one last question and then we go on, because I will explain more about this tomorrow, the insight into who decided to ask these questions.
Why bother having the illusion of conscious will? Like, it doesn't cause it, but there's that feeling that of delusion that you are causing it. But it has no function, but there's that feeling of delusion. So is the answer to that, that whole thing about the box, that there's illusion so you can break the illusion, or how would you explain
why that illusion is, I'm not sure. I think a lot of it is culturally ingrained in us, learned at school. The sense of identity which you learn as a child. I'm not a child psychologist, but I think that's probably where you could start to find this idea of autonomy. There are some societies where, you know, you don't have the same autonomy and self-identity as in the Western culture. Some where actually you're part of the group and you identify with the group. You're not different than the tribe. You really are. You are a group. You're not an individual. So you never think that you're in charge. The group is in charge. Yes, really cool. But in Buddhism, no one's in charge. Isn't that wonderful? You've got no one to blame. No one to criticize. Isn't that wonderful? Get away with anything now. Is there a difference between entering jhana through metta meditation and this method that you teach? No, there's no difference at all, because it's all letting go. It doesn't matter what you are watching, as long as you're making peace with it, being kind and being gentle. So if your object is metta meditation, as long as you're making peace with metta, being kind, being gentle, then it works. Which is why the old story I tell at every retreat, sometimes people can't do breath meditation, they have difficulty with breath meditation, so I teach them anapanasati. And if they can't do anapanasati, then I teach them metta meditation. If they can't do metta meditation, I teach them loving kindness. If they can't do loving kindness meditation, I teach them letting go. If they can't do letting go meditation, I teach them just peace meditation. If they can't do peace meditation, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they forgot that's where they started. And you may know, if you know a little bit of Pada, the breath is anapana. Metta is loving kindness. It's all exactly the same. But we teach it from different angles just to sort of make people interested, that's all. It's all exactly the same. All it is, you're holding on to something, you just put it down. Letting go. Stillness. Peace. So it doesn't really matter sort of what you're aware of. So you let it go. Lastly, what has happened to the consciousness when someone suffers from Alzheimer's? I can't remember. Okay, Alzheimer's jokes. I know Alzheimer's jokes. The guy who went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I am terribly sorry, I found two diseases in you. Oh dear, what are those two diseases? The first is cancer and it's terminal. Oh my goodness, I got cancer, that's terminal. What's my second disease? You've got Alzheimer's. Oh, at least I haven't got cancer. Okay, other Alzheimer's jokes. The nice thing about Alzheimer's, you're always meeting new people. Who's got a good Alzheimer's joke to finish off with? Ah, come on. Okay, you haven't. But what happens to consciousness with Alzheimer's? It just like goes to sleep. What happens to your consciousness when you dull out or when you're having an operation? You haven't left the body. It just dulls out. It stops for a little while. Remember that simile? Sort of coconut, banana. The plate is empty for a while. And then a coconut comes back again. And just with Alzheimer's, you know, what's happening there is just the coconut and the banana are just really, really grey. It's just like really low mindfulness, like being sleepy. You're not really quite sure what's going on. But when you die, that's when you get your memory back. That's why, apparently, and I wasn't there when my mother died, she died in her sleep, but some people actually say that they've been with their parents or loved ones when they have Alzheimer's, and just before they die, as if, oh, they can recognize you again. Oh, son, what are you doing here? And that's a sign that their mind is separating from their brain, and it can actually understand again. There was a wonderful documentary which somebody sent me from the BBC. I think we might still have it somewhere in the monastery. There was this young man, well, not young man, middle-aged man, who had this sudden loss of memory. And, you know, from a certain time and a certain day, he couldn't remember anything of the past. He can still remember the skills about, you know, how to brush his teeth, maths, how to go to the bank, but just the details of his life, he totally forgot. And he just recently got married again for the second time, maybe 6 months. He couldn't even recognize his new wife. He recognized nothing. So he had to relearn everything again. And when they wanted to find out why this happened, they gave him brain scans. They couldn't find anything wrong. He didn't have a stroke or whatever. But in his documentary, they put him under hypnosis. And under hypnosis, he remembered everything. What had happened, he'd been in his little workshop in the back garden. This was some time ago, before mobile phones. The phone in his house rang, and he rushed out to answer it. The shutter of the workshop was open. He just banged his head on the shutter. And that just knocked out his previous memory. And in the hypnosis, he could remember everything, all the details. And they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion to please remember when you come out. So he came out of hypnosis and he couldn't remember a thing. Under hypnosis, he could remember everything. But in real consciousness, he couldn't. When you're under hypnosis, you can access the mind, you can bypass the brain. But in a real life, you know, you have to go through the brain. And it's the Alzheimer's, the disease of the brain blocks you. But when that brain stops working and you're free again, then you can remember everything. That's why people, when they die, just before they die, they can remember everything. If I had been there with my mother when she had her last breath, if she was awake, not asleep, Peter, I jumped up, how are you at Perth? What's going on down there? She'd remembered everything. And that's actually well attested, it happens. There's many cases. That's what happens with Alzheimer's. You're blocked out by this diseased brain for a while. But afterwards you come back again. It's anicca. Very good. Okay. So, before I keep you that long that you all get Alzheimer's, it's now time to go to bed. So, before you go to bed, what happens? Sadhu! 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 Hee hee hee. Very good.